Our next case for argument is United States v. Askew Bell. Ms. Gauss.
Like other suppression cases, this case is tough because incriminating evidence was found. This case is also tough because there's no evidence that the officer was acting maliciously on the day of Ms. Askew Bell's arrest. Nevertheless, Fourth Amendment lines were crossed, and Fourth Amendment rights must be upheld, not just for this case, but for future encounters between citizens and police officers. In our briefs, we've laid out the Fourth Amendment violations that we believe occurred on the day of Ms. Askew Bell's arrest. And any one of those violations...
Where is it that you think there was a failure of probable cause here?
We believe there was not probable cause until Ms. Askew Bell fled from the police officer. We do not believe there was probable cause before that time, because there was no evidence linking her to the
bank
robbery.
But she was giving all these evasive, making all these evasive statements, and she resembled the robber. So I think they could have arrested her, let alone, you know, stopped her.
Hmm? Well, to address the evasive comments, they weren't necessarily evasive to the police officer. He didn't know that she was giving a false name. He thought it was suspicious. That's not necessarily probable cause that she had committed a crime.
Your own name does seem rather suspicious.
It seems suspicious, but it can also be a function of a person being very nervous when being approached by a police officer and being told that you...
Well, why is she nervous unless she's guilty?
A lot of people who are approached in the street by police officers get nervous even if they have nothing to hide. In terms of not having probable cause before she fled, we believe there wasn't reasonable suspicion based on the descriptions that the officer had either. The description, as he himself admitted, was very generic. It was black, female, heavy set or pregnant, wearing clothes on the day of the robbery, and of course this stop took place several weeks after that. The photographs are not of a very good quality. The officer himself testified they are not good still life photos. When he was asked about those photos, he couldn't give anything specific as to Ms. Askew Bell, such as her face or her age, that made her resemble that suspect in the photos. So we do not believe that there was probable cause to connect her to criminal activity before she started to flee.
Are the photos better than the ones we have in the brief?
They are slightly better. The government supplemented the record with a couple of the photos. When you look at those, the ones that the officer had on the day of the arrest are Exhibits 1 and 3. They're still fairly blurry. I mean, they are Xerox copies. They're black and white. From my estimation, it's difficult to see facial features or anything like that. And as I said, the officer himself testified that they were not good still life photos. And that's one of the reasons we believe there was not enough for reasonable suspicion to stop her here. But even if...
Well, first encounter is sort of an inquiry. They're trying to say that's consensual and all that. There's no reasonable suspicion necessary just to have this encounter on the street, is there?
That's correct, Your Honor. There is not reasonable suspicion necessary if it is consensual.
And these things sort of evolve, it seems. Right. That's the case here. We've got this that keeps getting into more and more, whatever you want to call it, suspicion and cause. But that, I guess that, was she wearing a different outfit? The picture, I know there are two pictures, different things she's wearing. There's something about carrying the purse high, and she was heavy set and maybe pregnant. And he thought this was a dead ringer or something.
He did say it was a dead ringer, but what the suspect was wearing on the day of a robbery several weeks earlier shouldn't necessarily help on a stop later.
It depends. I'm just wondering if that she coincidentally was wearing that, but apparently her aunt or somebody's in a nursing home in the vicinity of these three banks.
That's correct. She was attempting to visit a family member in a nursing home.
Maybe that's how she got away each time. It's sort of weird that she's on foot and heavy set and maybe pregnant and can rob three banks without getting caught.
Well, it's our position she shouldn't have been stopped on this day either, and that violations occurred. And even if this court finds that there was reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop or arrest her, that still leaves the final violation that we've identified and that we think is most problematic, which is the warrantless search of her purse. From the facts here, she's arrested by a second officer on the nursing home lawn. She's being handcuffed. The first officer has already seized her purse earlier, not during the arrest, but earlier. That first officer is approximately 15 feet away from her, which is probably as far away as the side wall here.
When they get her to the police station, they'd look through the purse anyway, wouldn't they?
Well, not necessarily. Not all inventory searches are permissible, the Supreme Court has said.
If you're looking for somebody who's an armed robber and you arrest them for armed robbery, wouldn't you look in the purse?
Well, they should have gotten a warrant, is our position.
When you get to the scene itself, you think that once you can't cuff a person, you have ceased to be able to pat them down to search for weapons or look in a purse?
No, we don't. And that's something that was raised by the government. Oh. If at the time of an arrest, you are allowed to search the person,
right.
You're allowed to search anything in their immediate control, grabbing area. The difference here, and what we think is problematic, is that that purse wasn't taken from her at the time of the arrest. It was seized from her earlier.
Well, she was trying to go into the bathroom. He didn't want her to go in there with the purse.
Correct.
And so he thought maybe we better get a female officer over here, do a little search, and that's when this tug-of-war or whatever it came took place. And then he's got the purse, and she takes off somewhere or other.
Right. He has the purse. He directs her to come away with him, which we think was a de facto arrest. As he's escorting her to the front of the nursing home, she attempts to flee. That first police officer still has the purse. She is then apprehended on the lawn by a second police officer, and then 15 feet away, that first officer still has the purse, dumps the entire contents, and starts searching through it.
They say when she took off that she abandoned the purse.
That is one of the government's arguments. We don't believe that it is fulfilled here because the cases cited for abandonment are cases where they're essentially dropsy cases where the defendant has voluntarily given up possession of an item. You know, someone's caught with a gun or drugs and they drop it right away. They voluntarily give up possession. Here, Ms. Esquivel didn't voluntarily give up possession of her purse. It was seized from her. And so you can't abandon what you have no longer control over. If I could reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Goss. Mr. Langer? Langer?
May it please the Court, my name is Ben Langner, and I represent the United States.
I'm curious about the sentence, 42 months for 3 bank robberies. Doesn't that seem awfully light?
I believe some of the reasons that the court considered below were the defendant's young daughter at the time, who obviously she was 8 months pregnant at the time of these robberies, so she had a young daughter. There were some other background factors that the judge considered.
Was this a guideline sentence?
No, it was below the guidelines.
What would the minimum guideline sentence have been?
You know, Judge, honestly, I don't remember exactly. I know it was probably another 20 or so months above that was the bottom end of the guidelines. As to exactly what the range was, I don't recall at this time.
Seems like a very low sentence for 3 bank robberies.
Well, obviously the government
maybe they were just low-grade banks, you know.
The government's
to be robbed.
The government's position here is that the initial interaction between the officer and the defendant was a consensual encounter. The situation we have here is one police officer approaching the defendant during the day on a public street, no weapons drawn, no forces used. The officer asks her if he can ask her a few questions, tells her that she looks like someone the police are looking for, and then proceeds to ask her name, address, date of birth, etc. This fact pattern fits within the framework that this court has set out for consensual encounters. The two facts that the defendant points to, the fact that the officer didn't tell her that she was free to leave, which the case law is clear that simply because somebody is not told that they're free to leave doesn't mean that it's a non-consensual environment. The second fact is that she was told that she looked like a suspect. That even in combination with the officer telling her that she's not free to leave doesn't create an intimidating enough environment that a reasonable person in that situation wouldn't still know that they're free to leave. The Sheets case, actually, that both parties cite to is a situation where a bank robbery suspect was taken by police officers into a security office and was told, we believe you committed a bank robbery, and they were waiting for a police officer to show up to identify this person. And this court found that that wasn't sufficient, at least up to that point in time, for it not to be a consensual encounter. Although we believe this was a consensual encounter, we also believe that the officer had reasonable suspicion from the time that he got out of the car. At that point in time, he knew that three banks within a mile and a half of one another had been robbed. He had seen pretty good quality color surveillance photographs. It wasn't as if he had just seen those two photocopies, which the government supplemented the record on appeal so that the judges could see those photographs, but he also had seen on a computer screen in a police station a better quality, as he described it, pretty good quality color surveillance photograph of the robber. As I said, he had in his possession these two black and white Xerox copies of the surveillance photographs, and based on those photos and descriptions, he knew that the bank robber was black, female, was heavyset or pregnant, was wearing dark sunglasses in both robberies, had carried her purse in a distinctive way high up underneath her arm, and during at least one of the robberies was wearing a white top and black pants. And then on September 8, 2006, the police officer driving by one of the banks sees the defendant. She's less than 100 yards away from one of the banks, walking directly at it. She's fits the description exactly. She's black, female, at this point heavily pregnant. She's wearing the dark sunglasses. She's got her purse in the same distinctive way, high up underneath her arm. She's wearing the white top and black pants. And not only does she match this description that he has, but in viewing the surveillance photographs, the ones that he saw on the computer and the ones that he has in front of him, he makes an unequivocal identification of her.
Was she pregnant?
She was pregnant.
Pardon?
She was pregnant, yes.
She was?
Yes.
So that's the first, a pregnant bank robber.
Not necessarily.
First that I'm aware of. And his words are, he makes clear that there was no hesitation for him. He says it was like a slap in the face. It was like, wow, there was no hesitation. He calls her a dead ringer. So he's making an unequivocal identification. The defendant argues that this identification is based on a generic description, but that argument misses the boat, I think, in two respects. First of all, while these factors may in isolation be common, it's the combination of all those factors together that give rise to reasonable suspicion here. And the second thing,
was apparently wearing the same or at least a very similar outfit.
Well, during one of the two robberies, she was wearing a white top and black pants,
yeah,
and in this case, she also wore similar clothing.
That's the picture we have.
Right.
We have two of them, but that one's more.
Right. In one of those two photos, she's wearing the white top and black pants. But the most important factor here is not just that she fit the description, but that he actually is identifying her based on these surveillance photographs. He's looked at these photographs, and especially, you know, the color surveillance one that he saw on the computer screen, he's saying this is the same person that I saw on that photograph. He is identifying her face and any other features that he can see in those photographs. In addition, because his actions don't actually give rise to an investigatory stop until a little bit later on, he's also had a chance to interact with her, and she's given these bizarre answers to him, saying that her name is Bertha Sharp and then being unable to spell her name, never owned a driver's license or a state ID. And then pretty soon after the officer starts talking to her, she says she has to go right back into the building she just came out of to use the restroom. So she's giving these bizarre answers, which further ripen his already reasonable suspicion.
Well, is it your view that he could have arrested her on the basis of his identification of her?
I'll preface my answer by saying the government did not argue this below.
But I'm just curious what you
based
think
on all that. The information, certainly once she started giving those bizarre answers, yes, I believe that would have...
No, I wondered if you thought before then. See, he had looked at the surveillance photos and she resembled the person in them. Would that be enough for...
Given the certainty of his answers, given the fact that he says there's...
I was thinking the dead ringer comment.
Right, exactly. And I think a very strong argument could be made that based on, you know, his answers or his description of his identification, that's a dead ringer. He has no hesitation that, yes, at that point in time, he had a pretty solid identification on this being the bank robber, and an argument could be made that he had probable cause at that point in time. Moving on to the Terry stop, the officer took two different actions that defendant argues went beyond what would ordinarily happen in a Terry stop, taking possession of her purse and asking the defendant to come away to the front of the Dobson Plaza. the district court looked at, you know, his reaction, the reason that he did these things, and found that it was a way to address legitimate concerns that he had, and also distinguished this situation from the Florida v. Royer and U.S. v. Ayanko case, which I think are very easily distinguishable on the fact that the officer's decision to take hold of the defendant's purse and ask her to come away to the front of the Dobson Plaza in this case was done in order to alleviate concerns that she was raising. She was the one that was saying, I need to use the restroom, I need my purse, I have to use my tampons. There's a number of things that she's creating, and it's the only reason that this situation went any longer or became any more intrusive than it otherwise would have been, which is really the standard that's being set out by Royer and Ayanko, was because of the defendant's actions here. And that's not the case in Royer and Ayanko, where it's the police officers who are putting somebody in an interrogation room or putting somebody in the back of a police car, and they're creating the situation. That's not the case here. Moving on to the search of the defendant's purse, the government offers several reasons why the search of the defendant's purse was justifiable, first of which is that this is a legitimate part of a lawful investigatory stop. United States versus Hernandez-Rivas case from 2003, this court held that a police officer during a lawful investigatory stop is permitted to look through a defendant's wallet or purse for identification. In this case, Officer Mazzella made very clear that what he was trying to do, his purpose in this investigatory stop, was to identify the defendant. He was not able to do that for a number of reasons. She, you know, needed to use the restroom. He had to go with her. She wanted to bring her purse in, and then she fled. So he wasn't able to identify her until he actually was able to subdue her in front of the Dobson Plaza. At that point in time, he had the ability under this court's case law to go through her purse and look for identification, and that's exactly what he did. He testified that he went into her wallet looking for identification and happened to find this additional evidence. That's exactly what happened in the Hernandez-Rivas case. A defendant was handcuffed by an officer. The officer went through his wallet to find his ID, and in doing so found $1,000, a fake ID, and some other evidence. The government also relies on search incident to arrest. Obviously, there does have to be a temporal and spatial proximity between the defendant and the item to be searched, but as Your Honor pointed out earlier, the probable cause arose, you know, at the latest at the point where she turned and fled, but probably really happened before that. And even at the time that she turned and fled, this purse was still easily within her reach, and only a few seconds beforehand had actually been in her exclusive control. And obviously, case law is clear that safe police procedure requires the officer to go and subdue her before actually searching the purse. The fact that there is some gap of time is only to accommodate that police procedure. Finally, the government also relies on abandonment. The Basinski case sets an example of abandonment where a defendant discards an item to make their flight easier. It's true the officer had possession of the purse, but he hadn't unilaterally taken it and was never going to give it back. He was only holding on to it while she used the restroom. So, you know, by her fleeing, she is relinquishing what right she did have over that purse. She made that decision to make her flight easier, and so abandonment is proper as well. Unless there are any further questions, the government will rely on its brief on all remaining points.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Langner. Ms. Gauss, how much time does she have?
3 minutes.
3 minutes.
The officer didn't just happen to find other items in her purse while he was looking for identification. He dumped the entire purse on the ground. He wasn't just looking for identification. In fact, his police report represents that he told the defendant at that point that he was looking for a gun.
Wasn't that prudent? I mean, her note in her bank robbery said she had a gun.
It may have been prudent to be concerned about that, but at that point, he had seized it earlier, and he was 15 feet away from her, and had full control of the purse, so there was no exigent circumstance or any danger to officer safety, which is the usual rationales for both search incident to arrest and the exigent.
Well, I don't understand. What are you saying? He should have detained her but gotten a search warrant for the purse? Is that
yes, the argument? That is our position.
What is the point of that? It's so pointless.
Well, the point is that that's the Fourth Amendment rules, and there's
certainly nothing in the Fourth Amendment about that. It just seems so ridiculous. Obviously, they're going to search the purse. What do you have to bring in a judge to with a warrant?
I don't think it's
common sense, does it?
I think here it does, because there isn't anything in the record that it would have been inevitably discovered.
Being protected by such an empty formality.
Maybe they didn't have a right to get a warrant for the purse. They had to
prove
that up.
Really? How could a judge turn down a warrant application?
Well, that's not an exception to the warrant.
I was going to say, this person is a bank robber, and she said she had a gun, and we can't look in the purse? Have to give her the purse back with a gun in it? What sense does that make?
Go through
I mean,
the
just
procedures.
Think of it. What sense does it make?
There's nothing in the record to support that that warrant would have been granted.
You're kidding.
Well, the problem is that your problem is that that's where the note was. It said whatever it said. I got a gun or something or other, robbing the bank, and apparently it was that was the problem. And I guess he didn't see that till he dumped it on the ground, or did he open it up and see?
That's correct. If he dumped it on the ground at that point, he's not just looking for identification. He's looking at everything in that purse. In plain view, on a public lawn in front of everyone and anyone. I mean, there are privacy interests here at stake. Perhaps if he had gotten a warrant later, that search would have been done in the privacy of a police station. It wouldn't be out in public view. I mean, the whole point of it is privacy interest, and who knows what other embarrassing things might have been in that purse, not incriminating things. And for that reason, if nothing else, they should have followed the proper procedure and gotten the warrant.
Well,
it very well may have
been. If the female officer had shown up to do the frisk or whatever they were going to do before she went in the bathroom, I assume she would have either held the purse or looked in it.
At that point, if Ms. Esquibel had not yet been arrested,
she wanted to go to the bathroom, and that was why they went in there.
They
so,
would,
so
right.
So he's obviously not going to frisk her and do whatever. I don't think he wanted to look in the purse, but he doesn't want her to take the purse in there, not knowing what's in it and that sort of thing, or whether she can get out. So that's why he put out someone else. Now, I can understand she said, I got to go now or something, but that wasn't seem what he meant.
So if I'll just finish my
sure.
answer. Our position is that he had other options at that point. He's not allowed to search the purse at that point without our consent, which is one option. He could ask to look in that purse. Our point was that by seizing the purse when he had other options, that was just far too intrusive and wasn't within the confines of a proper Terry stop at that point. He had other options. He could have frisked the purse, asked for consent, look in the restroom, that sort of thing.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Gauss, and thank you for accepting the appointment. And